Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Risky Business, coming to you from the Kickstart IT Media Conference on the Sunshine Coast. We won't be sticking to our typical format today, and that's because we've got security people coming out of our ears. We'll be joined by McLennan Starkey, Macca, a security analyst from Ossert. We're also joined by Michael May, who is the sales director for Trend Micro in Australia. Stephen McDonald, Checkpoint Software Technologies Engineering Manager, is here with us, as is fellow journalist Ian Yates and our sponsor Cybertrust, who is represented here today by Andrew Walls, the company's principal security consultant. Normally we get the ball rolling with a news summary, courtesy of ZDNet Australia's Munir Katadia, but today we're calling on Mr. Ian Yates, a fellow freelance journalist like myself. And in a few weeks you'll be able to hear Ian on itradio.com.au presenting our all-new show, A Series of Tubes, which is sponsored by Dimension Data. Ian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Pat.
Okay. Just looking over the news, we've had a couple of bumper weeks of news, and this week it's actually been a little bit more subdued, but we've seen reports that identity theft is continuing to climb.
Yes, it's no surprise really, is it? It's been one of these common topics that continues to get airplay, and also it attracts the attention of the mainstream media. Nothing like a good scary internet story to keep them interested.
Well, the internet is bad and must be burned at the stake.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. With a few sacrificed goats, I think.
Now, on the ACCC actually said about this that on identity theft alone, losses to the Australian community are estimated to be in excess of $1 billion annually. It would be very interesting to know where they sourced that figure.
I agree. That's a really big, scary number. And you would think at that level of identity theft fraud, you'd hope to actually meet somebody yourself who'd been a victim.
Now, we noticed that Microsoft has taken a break from its Patch Tuesday and didn't actually put out anything, despite at least 5 zero-day vulnerabilities that are waiting to be fixed.
Yes. The community, of course, the open source community is taking great pride in that fact, as they always do whenever Microsoft stumbles. And being that big, they seem to stumble regularly. I guess it's a matter of Microsoft preferring, let's be generous, saying they haven't got fixes that are ready, so rather than put out a half fix, they're waiting to get a real fix.
Well, I've interviewed the guys from the Security Response Center and also the dev teams over in Redmond, and the amount of regression testing they have to do on those patches is nothing short of staggering. They have to make sure that it doesn't break anything. And when you think of the combinations and permutations for every bit of software that they run, I mean, that's a fairly big job. We've also got we'd bin this in the comical category, which is Microsoft's antivirus deleting users' email. Now, we're not talking about actual individual emails. We're talking about PST or DBX files getting just erased from hard drives.
Yeah, this is one of these things that's really funny to read about unless it's you it happened to. And seemingly, they are unable to make a difference between a single virus coming in and raising the red flag and saying the whole thing's a virus and just shut it down.
Well, it's like saying the virus is in the PST file, which is where all the email is. Let's just get rid of the whole thing. In fact, I mean, couldn't they extend that logic perhaps? And, you know, if there was a virus on a hard drive, they could just nuke the whole thing.
I think that would be the right approach. When they detect a virus coming into Windows, it should automatically delete the entire hard disk.
Ian, thanks a lot for having a chat to us right now.
Thanks for that, Pat.
Normally on Risky Business, it's about now that we talk to Ossert's Chief Operations Manager, Carl Hanmore. But because we're up at the Kickstart Media Conference here on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, we actually have access to a security analyst from Ossert who can appear in person. His name is McLennan Starkey and he joins us now. Macca, thanks for taking time out.
Thanks for having me, Patrick.
So, Macca, can you tell us what's been happening over the last week? I understand that Thursday before last, you guys were actually subjected to a fairly large-scale denial-of-service attack.
Ossert started experiencing a distributed denial-of-service attack from a botnet. The number of requests coming in were medium to high to start with. The attack did intensify several days later, and then again on Saturday morning we started hitting a peak of about 700 requests per second.
That's a fair few, isn't it?
That is quite a few.
Do you express that as hertz?
No, we don't.
So it's not 700 hertz? It's not a 700 hertz denial of service attack?
Actually, it's probably, from our perspective, more megahertz than hertz.
Now, look, we had a chat last week to Carl about these PHP vulnerabilities that he was quite concerned about. Have we seen any further developments there? Is there any exploit code floating about for those ones?
We haven't seen, at this point in time, any exploit code that is publicly out there. I imagine there probably is some up on the usual forums. We haven't seen a large uptake of that. What we have seen, though, that's quite interesting is that the source code for a very, very popular blogging piece of software called WordPress was trojaned.
Yeah, now someone actually managed to break into the source repository and just insert some really vulnerable code. So it wasn't really an overt trojan. It was just something that was clearly really easy to exploit, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And that was that does appear to have been the intention. The intention appears to have been for the attacker to be able to, at later times, go back to systems which had been compromised using this code, which was downloaded from the WordPress servers, and execute code on those servers with the level of privilege that that was given to Apache or to the PHP.
Well, you'd almost consider it lucky that they got it, and you've got to wonder how many of these things don't get caught. I mean, particularly in open source where a lot of people can come in. I mean, they're sort of like a software wiki, aren't they? Anyone can sort of come in and add chunks of code. I mean, do you guys imagine that there's a fair few Trojaned sort of source repositories out there that don't really get discovered until much later?
One of the benefits of them being open source is that they are often viewed very, very widely by the public. Most guys find them if it's out there and if it was intentional. Whether or not it was intentional is something that is very, very hard to determine.
Or, you know, I mean, I suppose it is a better scenario than if there's some sort of rogue coder who gets pissed off with his boss one day working at software vendor X, puts in a Trojan which gets compiled. You know, it's less visible. I mean, I suppose that's the rationale you're talking about, isn't it?
Absolutely. We certainly have seen that in the past as well. I remember last year there were several products which were released with Windows malicious code on there.
Sounds great.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
Which vendor was that?
I mean, I believe it was Apple.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed. Brilliant. Nothing like getting owned by a Mac or an iPod in that case.
Oh, I do remember that. Yes, the iPod, which had the Windows virus on it, that was a bag of fun.
Absolutely.
And us, we got to say, in the IT media, we do sincerely appreciate it when things like that happen because we get to have a lot of fun with it. Now, as usual, we're joined by our sponsor, or a representative from our sponsor, which this week is Andrew Walls, who's the principal consultant from Cybertrust, and Cybertrust pay our bills, so we like to have them on once a week. Andrew, you've got some breaking news.
We're seeing some lack of activity from a popular DNS provider in the United States called GoDaddy. It's basically a domain registrar. And what seems to be the case is that as a result of the forwarding of the date for daylight savings time transition in the United States to this past Sunday, as in the day before today, a lot of people were caught unawares and had not downloaded appropriate patches from their vendors to correct daylight savings time changes and also amending their own local time standards. In this case, GoDaddy in particular is based in Arizona, which is not performing the daylight savings time change on yesterday. They thought that their systems would not be required to have the updates as a result. The suspicion at this point is that they've run into issues as a result of the daylight savings time change that occurred in other localities, and they have as a result gone offline. Their systems are up and talking to the public, but the domain registrar function has ceased to function.
So does this mean anyone with a GoDaddy... I should point out to our listeners, we're actually recording this on a Monday afternoon. Mm-hmm. At this point, as we are recording, it seems that GoDaddy domains have just gone dark. Anyone who registered a domain through
GoDaddy? For the moment, but again, even as we speak, they may have come back up.
Yeah.
So this is a very fluid situation, and GoDaddy is dealing with it, and they are putting out messages saying they're quite aware of the problem and they're chasing the technical fix. So I have no worries about their ultimate viability. They will come back up, and we expect that this is just a momentary lapse. The shock of having a daylight savings time transition occur 2 weeks earlier than normal has been felt all around the world. All the major vendors, Microsoft leading the way, have been pushing out all sorts of patches to their calendaring applications, to their operating systems, in order to deal with this change. We're expecting in a lot of corporate environments, as a result of this change, for meetings to go mismanaged because I thought it was at 2:00. No, yeah. I thought it was at 3:00 and so forth.
Yeah.
So it's going to have a ripple effect across the business.
GoDaddy made itself quite unpopular in the security community when it removed the secklist.org domain name. It just dropped it off the face of the earth because they'd had a request from MySpace. Someone had apparently posted a list of passwords to a mailing list archived by secklists.org, and GoDaddy happily pulled the pin.
Not the preferred way to deal with an exposure of passwords. One would recommend that everyone change their password and not worry about the list that's out in the wild.
Mm.
And a little bit healthier practice.
Once it's already, I mean, you know, once something's exposed, it's exposed.
Exactly.
And, you know, they're saying, look, pull it off the web. It's already gone out on a mailing list subscribed to by every single miscreant.
Yeah, there's copies
hacker,
all around the world.
Black hat, you know, it's on the peer-to-peer network.
The general approach we would recommend is that if it's exposed, assume it's compromised. Okay. And so shut it down, rebuild it. Put it out there.
Andrew Walls, thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're going to have a bit of a chat to Stephen McDonald, who is the engineering manager for Checkpoint Software Technologies here in Australia. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Patrick.
Now, I just hoped we could get a bit of an update on where you guys are at with your acquisition of Network Flight Recorder, because obviously that's a fairly big development for Checkpoint.
Absolutely. Checkpoint successfully completed the acquisition of NFR Security on the 8th of January, which is very exciting for us in that we've now launched a new product termed IPS1, so which has come out of their CentOS product range.
IPS1, Firewall1, VPN1. I'm detecting a bit of a theme here.
Seems to be a theme.
Excellent. So have you actually begun integrating that product into your range, or, I mean, how will that work?
Yeah, look, so we've already started internal training on the product with our field staff. We've got demo units out there. The product has been rebadged, and obviously we're well underway in our integration plans. We have a confirmed roadmap. Obviously, Checkpoint's strength is unified management, and we have to get this right, and it will be done as a matter of priority.
When can we expect a release?
At the moment, I don't have a specific date to give you.
Okay. It's just been interesting to watch Checkpoint over the years, because obviously a company known for making extraordinarily good firewalls, but also a company that really doesn't want to be known for making extraordinarily good firewalls. Is this part of a broader push to sort of diversify what it is that you offer to the market?
Yeah, look, Checkpoint realistically hasn't sold pure firewalls for many, many years now, ever since the VPN1 release in the 4.0 days of the product. So Checkpoint's had a long-standing wide approach to security, ranging from endpoint security with our secure client integrity products, all the way through to our IPS capabilities and smart defense. So,
well, I suppose you just developed a little bit more room in the market, depending on how the ISS acquisition with IBM goes. I mean, that's seen some of their products wind up with IBM, and IBM seem more interested in the services side, which has a lot of analysts predicting that they're just going to cull off some of those IPS and endpoint security agents. I mean, how are you finding the markets responding? I mean, I know you're more in the engineering side, and you're not a sales guy, but are you finding that people are taking maybe a second look at your products, given what's happened with IBM and ISS?
Yeah, look, there's no question, specifically with the ISS-IBM play. People are now looking at Checkpoint for multiple products because of our unified management architecture. But if I look at that in a bit more detail, Checkpoint's never been famous specifically in the IDS space. So this is our chance to get that right and deliver a really good service and product.
Yeah, and it was unfortunate, but you guys got off on the wrong foot, I guess, with the attempted acquisition of Snort, which is, you guys being an Israeli company trying to buy a US company, it got kiboshed by the appropriate word, actually, kiboshed by the US government, who weren't too keen on an Israeli company owning, you know, a code repository that's used in a lot of very top secret applications.
Checkpoint's gone with the most effective product. Or company acquisition that it could. Specifically, we remain true to our strategy of getting one of the best and leading IDS and IPS capabilities in the market and bring that in-house.
Stephen, thanks a lot for talking to us here on Risky Business.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're listening to Risky Business, sponsored by CyberTrust. This week, we're recording at the Kickstart IT Media Conference on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. It's essentially a gab fest where IT vendors and journalists can get together once a year to have a chat about all sorts of things. And right now we're joined by Michael May, who is the sales director for Trend Micro in Australia. And he's very kindly agreed to give up some of his time to have a chat.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So, Michael, I guess I wanted to speak to you about the AV market in general. We've seen the commercial release of Vista. Has that had much of it? Do you anticipate that that's going to have much of an effect on your business or the way that you actually have to write your products?
Well, I think it's early days for Microsoft at this point in time, and it certainly does lend credibility to the market when you've got a major corporate like Microsoft in endorsing, you know, the profile that security does have as a business driver. It is early days, as I said, and I believe that from an enterprise perspective, I don't think it's an opportunity yet. However, on the desktop for the small to medium user and probably for the home user, it certainly is an option that we've got to look at it very carefully.
Industry. Consumers have been to the antivirus industry what classifieds were to Fairfax, you know, those rivers of gold, that endless supply of cash that just seemed to flow into the coffers. I mean, do you really think it's going to have a decimating effect on the revenue stream of companies like yourselves?
I don't believe so. As I said, once again, it's still very early, but also when you look at the price point of the software, it does not have that much of a major impact on corporations, the likes of Trend and our other peers in the marketplace today.
So what proportion of your revenue approximately comes from consumer versus enterprise?
If you looked at the Australian ANZ market, probably about 60-40 would be enterprise, 40% would be consumer, small to medium.
It's very interesting. I mean, there's few businesses where you wind up having your software sales being fairly evenly split between the enterprise and the commercial sector. Do you think that there will be an increased emphasis from the antivirus vendors on the enterprise market?
Very much so. Speaking with our major customers just last week, when we discussed with them, you know, what are the issues that are affecting their business, security is becoming much higher profile, and they're getting far larger budgets being made available to them to spend, particularly when you look at sectors like government, public utilities, and banking finance sectors. So it is a significant part and will grow substantially, particularly when you look at the types of attacks that are happening in that sector at the moment. I think the concept of a virus at the desktop where someone is doing it for notoriety purposes is long gone. The issue now is how can I make money? And as I think you made mention earlier, there's a significant amount of money made available. There's an interesting statistic that came out just recently. There's a 2006 US Treasury report which stated that there's more money to be had on online crime, particularly when you compare it to the illegal drug trade. So that's a serious amount
of
money.
Well, Mick Keelty, the Australian Federal Police Commissioner, was addressing a function held by the American Chamber of Commerce in Sydney, and he said that, to addressing a business audience, he said that data on your hard drive is as valuable as a kilo of heroin. Mm. So it really does seem to be an increasing problem for law enforcement as well, because unlike a kilogram of heroin, data is much easier to hide.
But the other point is targeted attacks are growing and making serious amounts of money, and that's what corporations are really concerned about.
Okay.
And that's the other driver for this particular opportunity.
Michael May, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to Risky Business, the weekly security podcast by itradio.com.au, sponsored by Cybertrust. I'm Patrick Gray. The so-called father of the internet, Dr. Vinton Cerf, who now serves as a vice president for Google, was in Brisbane last week to open a charity called the Hear and Say Foundation, which is a charity for deaf and hearing impaired children. Dr. Cerf's wife, Sigrid, has two cochlear implants, so he was more than happy to donate his time to the fundraiser. Now, I recorded some of that speech and thought many of the Risky Business listeners might be interested to hear what the father of the internet, or the man who co-wrote the TCP/IP protocol, had to say about some of the problems that are plaguing the internet today.
Internet spread and its use by the general public have introduced some risk factors. I mean, we all deplore the fact that spam seems to be everywhere, that there are viruses and worms, there's fraud and other kinds of abuse on the net, there's misinformation that some people put up deliberately and some put up only because of ignorance. This is partly a side effect of the commercialization of the network. It's partly a side effect of the general public being online. And although I don't argue that there's nothing to be done about this, in fact, there are some very specific technical steps that we could take to reduce the effects of some of these annoying practices. In fact, we may also need to use legislation, both on a national and even an international scale, in order to explain to people that certain things are going to be socially unacceptable, and if we catch you doing them, there will be consequences. We've had to go through the same thing in other technologies. For example, you can commit fraud, with the postal service over the telephone system, and it's illegal. And if they catch you doing it, you wind up either going to jail or paying a fine or both. I've already focused pretty hard on the end-to-end principle and innovation at the edge, and I just want to emphasize again how important it is to keep the network open to innovation so that new Googles and new Amazons and so on can be invented by young people with good ideas.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. We'll be back next week with another special edition, because I'll be in Germany at the world's largest IT trade show, CeBIT, in Hanover. So I'll be walking through the trade floor to find out what's on offer at this absolutely spectacular event. Until next week, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.